Welcome to Power Play. On a day when the government took legislative action against harassment and sexual violence in the workforce, coming up on today's show, the minister behind the bill explains how her plan attacks the findings of that shocking survey from last week, which showed the harassment problem is rampant. And how many billions of Canadian dollars are stashed in tax havens overseas is mostly a mystery. We will ask a senator trying to uncover the dollar signs why this and the previous government kept so much untaxed cash a secret. And the inevitable charter challenge has been launched against Quebec's face covering ban. We will talk to a lawyer behind that court challenge. But first, the Liberals continue to be knocked back on their heels as the party accused of protecting the rich while increasingly taxing the middle class. The slow drip of the ongoing tax revelations is tonic for the opposition parties and toxic to the Liberal middle class brand. Revelations about the 3,600 Canadian individuals and companies with billions stashed legally in offshore havens continue to reverberate in the House of Commons today.
While looking out for his friends and insiders, the Prime Minister put a target on the pocketbooks of hardworking Canadians. He accuses local business owners of being tax cheats even while he's raising their taxes, but he turns a blind eye to the loopholes that his friends enjoy using. It's almost as if there's one set of rules for the Prime Minister and his wealthy friends, and another set of rules for everybody else.
This is the same CRA that forgave the clients who made millions from the KPMG scheme, and this is the same CRA who failed to act on the Panama Papers. When will the minister stop defending the CRA and start standing up for Canada?
This government is a government that recognizes that small businesses are the backbone of the Canadian economy and that they are community builders. We want to see them succeed, and that's exactly why we have committed to lowering the small business tax rate to 9%. By 2019. And I really look forward to members opposite recognizing that small businesses are the backbone of the economy and they should be paying a lower tax rate.
All right, let's bring in someone who has been on a mission to track and tax Canadian money heading into offshore accounts to escape Revenue Canada. Percy Down is an independent senator who spent years pushing for action against tax avoidance. He joins me in the studio. Senator, thanks for coming to the show. I mean, the government says they're in full investigation mode. $1 billion has been allocated to find these people who are, I guess you can't call them cheats particularly, because they're taking advantage of a plan. Are they wrong? Are they not doing this?
Well, you're right. It's not illegal to have an account overseas. It is, however, illegal not to declare the proceeds of the account. What I've asked the government for a number of years now is just to be more transparent, more open. Tell us what they're doing. 8 years ago, we had a leak from a bank in Liechtenstein. That one bank had 102 Canadians with accounts there, over $100 million. In fact, you couldn't open an account unless you had $500,000. Mm-hmm. Years later, we found out that the government determined there were some taxes owing, but not one Canadian got charged and not one got convicted. So this is very different from other countries around the world. When they saw what happened in Liechtenstein, they immediately swung into action. People were charged, convicted, went to jail, and it was all public. In Canada, it's very secret. The second thing I've asked the revenue agency to do is calculate the tax gap, the difference between what is being collected and what should be collected. Mm-hmm. It also does a second thing as well. It tells you how efficient your revenue agency is, which may be part of the problem.
Okay, so is what you're talking about from Liechtenstein the same as what's going on in the Cayman Islands that's been revealed by these Paradise Papers? Is that apples and apples comparisons?
Yeah, it's all continuation of a series of leaks. After Liechtenstein, we had a leak from Switzerland.
Right.
One bank there were 1,785 Canadians with accounts. The CRA refused to tell us anything about that. Now, then we had the Panama Papers, and then now we have the Paradise Papers. So there's a problem here. The degree of it is what we don't know.
Why aren't they going after it? It's money sitting there waiting to be collected. It seems to me, if they're right, saying that the little bit they've invested, the amount they've invested, triggers an awful lot more in the way of bringing tax revenue. Why wouldn't you go whole hog on it?
Well, that's a good question. The problem is we don't know how big a problem it is. The Conference Board of Canada, for example, earlier this year, did a tax gap analysis, and they estimated it's up to $47 billion. Now, imagine if the government ever collected that, there'd be no deficit, taxes would be lowered, programs would be funded on a host of programs that now the government can't afford.
So is there, I mean, I don't want to put conspiracy theories in your head, but is there a sort of a code here that says there's a cozy relationship between politicians and upper-class businessmen and they just don't want to find out how bad they are?
Well, there's a good question. You know, I've always said it's a lack of resources in the revenue agency and it's a lack of will. Well, now this government has given, in two separate budgets, close to $1 billion. Of course, the CRA is being misleading, saying it's $1 billion. It's over a number of years. I asked them in writing, in a written question, the Senate, on 2016-2017 fiscal year, they spent less than $40 million. It's a long way from $1 billion.
Wow. And are they staffing up? Is there insufficient staff? Is that what you're finding?
Well, the big part is there's a culture of secrecy at the CRA that I believe hides a culture of incompetency. They do a very good job on domestic tax evasion. If anybody tries to cheat in Canada, you're charged, convicted, fined, sometimes you go to jail, just check their website. The CRA website has a number of these people listed. There's not one listing, and I checked today, for overseas tax evasion. Seems to be a double standard.
You come straight out of the ranks of Liberals. You were at the Prime Minister's office under Mr. Chrétien. Do you think this whole tax thing is stigmatizing the brand? Is it having an impact politically?
Well, I'm not sure about that. But what it is showing is that not enough attention has been paid to the revenue agency. I know when I worked in government, nobody asked a question about the revenue agency. The money came in. Everything was secret, as it should be. I don't want to know your income tax. You don't want to know mine. But all we're asking on the tax cap is to give the raw data to the parliamentary budget officer, which I asked for 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. The parliamentary budget officer tried to do that, and they won't cooperate. They're stonewalling.
Nice segue, Senator Down, because we're going to thank you now, and we will switch gears a little bit. And I want to bring in Mustafa Askari. He's with the Parliamentary Budget Office, which has been rebuffed for years, trying to find out how much money escapes taxation. Mr. Askari, tell us about the experience of the PBO in dealing with Revenue Canada. What have you tried to find out, and what have they told you?
Well, since 2013, excuse me, we have asked the CRA to provide us with tax information. And we wanted to estimate the tax gap, and we needed to have access to all taxes for personal and corporate taxes. Mm-hmm. And the CRA refused to do that. And we have had over 10 letters back and forth with CRA. We have had a number of meetings with legal counsels, and we have argued that we, for the parliamentarians, we have to have access to this information. And CRA, they have refused to give it to us based on the Section 241 of the Income Tax Act, and they say that privacy and confidentiality of the income tax does not allow them to provide that information to us. We argued against that, but mm-hmm. we couldn't convince them. Mm-hmm. And This has been going on for 5 years.
Do they have the right to say no? Or can you take them to court and say we're going to force you to do this?
We can. Obviously, that's one way of doing it, to take them to court. We haven't done that. But again, it's an option. But I think the issue is that Parliament can actually solve this problem by amending the Income Tax Act to give Parliamentary Budget Office access to tax information. There are a number of other organizations that have access, like the Auditor General or the Department of Finance. So that's easy. It's a very simple amendment can actually deal with that, and then there won't be any issue.
Are you actually seeking individuals' tax returns, or are you looking for global amounts that would show you the tax gap?
Well, we have to have access. We don't necessarily need to see names and we need the information for individual taxpayers, and then we need information for tax audits, and then with that we have the methodology that provide the tax gap. However, those numbers are never precise, as everybody knows. Other countries do that, and there is always a range, and there is uncertainty about those numbers. But as long as you get the magnitudes, the order of magnitudes right, it gives you an idea. And as the Senator Percy just mentioned, that's the first step, and then that will give the CRA or the government an idea of how much money they need to invest to actually recoup those taxes they have lost.
Can you even wildly guess how much money we're talking about?
Really hard to say. I mean, the conference board had the $40 billion, but we're not. That was a very simple methodology. And they didn't have access to all the taxes that they needed to have access to. So I don't know how reliable that number is. But I mean, the income tax, just the amount that is not reported or from the underground economy. The CRA itself has estimated that about $8.7 billion.
Wow.
Now, that does not include offshore taxes.
It doesn't. Just the
internal, and that does not even include illicit activities. Mm. So it would be a large number, certainly.
Is it frustrating to you that you don't have the complete picture then?
Well, I mean, frustrating to the sense that we have been asked to do this and we can't do it, and it's important. And this kind of access is not only important for this project; it's important for a number of other things, because we now, under our mandate, we have to cost election platforms in the next election.
That's right.
If there are any kind of tax proposals that require access to tax information, we won't be able to do that, and that's obviously an issue.
Just to verify one thing that's in play here, they have dedicated $1 billion to this. It's just over several years. Is that right?
Well, there's budget for $1 billion. How much of it, and that's over the number of years. How much of it they have actually spent? I don't know that. I mean, that's necessary.
I'll bet you get asked by some MPs to do that soon, though.
Yeah.
Anytime you have a question, I'm sure an MP wants to find the answer too.
Exactly.
All right, Mr. Scarry, thanks for coming on. As always, it's a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up, a push to make the workplace harassment free. Please stay with us. Well, the government moved to crack down on sexual violence and harassment in the workplace today. Federally regulated employers from Parliament Hill to chartered banks to CTV will be covered by the new regulations to prevent and react to incidents with added support for the victims. Patty Haidu is the bill sponsoring Minister of Employment and Labor. She joins me in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tom.
We talked last week about that survey that showed 60% of those surveyed had experienced some form of harassment and 30% had experienced sexual harassment. How is this legislation going to stomp down that statistic?
Well, first of all, most importantly, what we hope is that there'll be tools in place and mechanisms in place to help prevent the behavior from happening in the first place. And that's a very important part of the legislation. There'll also be a component of the legislation that'll be about responding and how employers are obligated to respond when someone brings forward a concern about experiencing harassment or sexual violence in the workplace. And finally, it's really about making sure that the mechanisms are in place to take that further if, in fact, they don't get the outcomes that they need. And the person who's experienced that harassment feels that their response hasn't been taken seriously.
How do you arbitrate that? I mean, you know, if you're in an office of three people, like an MP might be with an assistant and a receptionist and that person and the one of the staff feels uncomfortable, who's going to arbitrate that?
Well, the legislation is proposing that there would be competent people that would be selected by employers as an alternative to speaking to the employer themselves. And of course, you highlight a small shop like an MP, but there are many other small businesses across the country that are federally regulated where, in fact, you're right, the perpetrator might be the employer. And so the legislation proposes that competent people, that means people that understand sexual harassment situations, that are neutral third parties, that are not biased towards one side or the other, and someone that understands the legislation would be available to receive complaints should the complainant feel that the employer isn't a safe person to talk to.
You know, we talked about the survey results last week, and one thing that struck me particularly was the large number of people that had experienced it, but how skeptical they were about the procedures that were in place to prevent it, that they didn't feel anything would be done anyway. So how does this change that channel?
Well, what this does is it provides employees with additional measures if, in fact, their complaint isn't taken seriously or they feel that the resolution that the employer has put forward isn't stringent enough or that the behavior continues. Mm-hmm. So they would be able to bring that complaint all the way forward to the labor program and ultimately the Minister of Labor, him or herself, to be able to address that concerns in a much more robust way. The labor program would have the ability through our inspection program to be able to do a thorough investigation, make recommendations to the employer, follow up on those recommendations, and ultimately, if those recommendations were not accepted or implemented, would be able to sanction the employer either through monetary sanctions or others.
And what would be the consequence to the person doing the sexual harassment, if that's what it is, or some kind of other harassment? I mean, if they're found sort of guilty, if you want to put it that way, what's the consequence?
Well, again, this happens on a continuum. So ultimately what we want is to be able to provide support to employers so that they can address early instances of harassment or bullying in a way that actually stops the behavior and allows that person and the person who is complaining to move forward in a productive way. But ultimately, each situation would have a different result. I mean, you know, employers may decide that a person's behavior is so egregious that they don't fit within that corporation anymore. Unions may decide that, you know, that person needs to be supported to have some form of recovery. So each situation would be different. The legislation is about providing that framework so that a thorough investigation is done, and that if the recommendations by either the employer or the labor board is not followed, that there would be recourse for the victim.
Where's, I'll play devil's advocate here for a bit, where's the presumption of innocence? Because usually in these cases, it's one person says, the other person says, and the stories are usually completely different. How do you, I mean, and we've heard of people filing false harassment claims against, out of vindictiveness or whatever, how do you find out the truth? I mean, there could be a case of a vindictiveness, finding a guy guilty when he didn't do anything.
Well, the majority of respondents to our survey said that when they actually took action to alleviate the situation that was happening to them, that nothing happened, and they felt very unsupported. And I would say that the majority of instances are not false claims, but that's why we will have a process that is thorough. And so, first of all, as I said, employers having a strong policy that clearly spells out what harassment is and what harassment isn't, and what steps people can take in early stages of a situation where there is feelings of unsafety, those are all very important parts of the entire regime.
Now, you've only had Parliament Hill experience for a couple years now, but do you think it's necessary? Like, how have you seen situations on Parliament Hill you think would be covered by this, that would prohibit this or stamp it out or discourage it?
I certainly have heard reports through the work that we did on gender-based violence. We've spoken with many different people that work in Parliament that you know, that are legislators themselves who have talked about situations that they've witnessed. So, you know, Parliament is an example of a workplace that is ripe for harassment and sexual violence. It is a place that has been traditionally a male-dominated space for over 150 years. It is a space where there are people with extreme amounts of power and people with very little power. And these are some of the things that the research experts told us create a greater likelihood that this could happen.
The Weinstein effect, in other words. You know, okay. Final quick question. Do you hope provinces and cities follow this as a template?
Certainly, we have an opportunity here at the federal level to show leadership. We certainly understand that it's our responsibility to protect the employees for which the Canada Labour Code covers. And I think that one of the benefits of working so closely with provinces and territories is the ability to share best practices and learn from each other. Right. So we will be sharing everything that we learn along the way with our colleagues.
Okay. It's going to take a while to roll this into regulations, but get her there quickly.
It's about changing a culture. We'll all have to work together.
Betty Heidi, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
All right, so what are your thoughts and your experiences with workplace harassment? Please reach out to us through social media on Facebook. There's Twitter and Instagram. You can also connect with us via email on this and any other topic. Our address is powerplay@ctvnews.ca. Coming up, the government's taxing problem gets the MP panel treatment. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, the Prime Minister has left the building, fled the building maybe, for an APEC summit on the far side of the world. But the MPs were rocking the House of Commons with plenty of taxing questions. Let's call on the MPs for the view from the Hill. Stephen McKinnon is a Quebec Liberal MP, Lisa Raitt, an Ontario Conservative MP, and Nathan Cullen, a BC NDP MP. Welcome to you all.
Thanks.
You guys still having a lot of fun in the House with this. How, Nathan, I'll start with you. How do you connect what's going on these lofty tax havens to try and get the average person to understand what's going on? It's a very complicated story in some ways, and yet you seem to think this is something that's capturing the public fancy.
Well, because most of the public actually pay their taxes and are looking for some sense, and believe the Prime Minister when he said, we're going to make the tax system fair. That was their small business thing that kind of flopped. Mm-hmm. And that he said, you know, the wealthy often don't pay their fair share of taxes. And we say, yeah, that's true. Canadians nodded. And then when you cast forward and you find out that the chief Liberal fundraiser, both for his dad and also for Justin Trudeau, are both people involved in offshore tax schemes, you sort of pull back and say, well, wait, is the fox literally running the hen house? And when you want to talk about fairness and all of us pitching in to pay for the hospitals and the roads and the schools, that's a great conversation to have. But these Paradise Papers that have now come out, similar to the KPMG scandal, similar to the Panama Papers, you find out that there's one set of rules for everybody and then a special set for the wealthy and well-connected who are able to move millions, billions of dollars offshore. And we can't even get the numbers out of the CRA, Don.
Yeah.
The Parliamentary Budget Office has been trying for 4 or 5 years.
Right.
They won't even tell us what the gap is, like how much money the country's owed from these wealthy offshore tax cheats.
Is it fair, though, Lisa, to draw a line between a friend of the prime minister's who denies having done this, but clearly a company he's involved with is using tax havens. But is it fair to draw a line and say, oh, Justin Trudeau's protecting his assets?
Well, it is. And it comes down to how they responded to this issue. And the Prime Minister made no bones about the fact that he thought doctors were the bad guys and doctors shouldn't be supported and that doctors were the problem and they weren't paying their fair share of taxes. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard a word about whether or not Mr. Bronfman should have paid a bigger portion of taxes. What I've heard is the speaking points from the Minister of National Revenue indicating that they're investigating, but not once has anyone on that side said, you know, this is a problem and we have to do better. And there's no demonization of Mr. Bronfman or anybody else, but boy, he took a good run at our small business people and our doctors this summer, didn't he?
Yeah, it's also interesting. You say you got $1 billion, but your own independent senator says you're not spending much of it.
That's right.
Well, look,
to find these tax havens, to find the people and get the money back.
Well, we actually are, and there's results to prove it. There have been 78 convictions. We've identified $25 billion in potentially taxable Canadian income. That will be evaluated. Well, of course, there's a process for these things. There's due process. That's what my friends on the panel would urge. But alone among the three people on this panel tonight, Don, our party identified this issue early and often, put it in our platform, and we've put money and substantial resources behind it so that we can get inspectors, we can work with our allies. We have a 50-country effort going on. You know, the Paradise Papers are about stories in Canada. They're also about stories all over the world. And if you read the New York Times or read the Financial Times or you read Le Monde, you will read similar stories about those respective countries. This is a problem. I don't think anyone denies or underestimates that this is a problem, but it's also something that has drawn the attention at the highest levels, including Canada. And for the first time, Canada's acting in concert with our allies and with other countries.
It's not the first time.
And we're reducing the incidence of this stuff.
For my Liberal colleagues, the only time they think an issue exists is when they notice it. Mm-hmm. The NDP have been raising this issue of tax havens going back 30, 40 years.
Well, we did something about it.
No, hold on. No, you did not. Actually, you know what they did about it? They signed another tax treaty for another tax haven with Cook Islands. So we do a massive amount of
trades.
Well,
that's how you get information.
Oh, this is not only how you get information. This is how the wealthy move their money offshore and then don't pay taxes on it. This is why these treaties exist, and this is why the Cayman Islands and all these different... Look...
But you don't just get the string words together, Don. I mean...
Well, no, that's called speaking. But one of the things that we notice is that the trend that has been going on, the former senator who worked for Pierre Trudeau sat on the Finance Committee and was blocking efforts to make these tax havens much more accountable to Canadians. This is the good senator. Now we see his protege holding fundraisers in the senator's house for Justin Trudeau with the same wealthy and well-connected people, and the tax haven problem continues. So they say they have identified money, but they won't even tell us what the tax gap is.
But, come on. To be fair, but they didn't get this information out of the Conservative government either. They tried.
Did. 2013 is when we started down the path of getting the information sharing with the other countries around the world that Stephen referenced. And as well, we set up a specific team within CRA to deal with this. And it's in our budget 2013 and it's in our budget 2015. So the fruits of our labor are being reaped by the Liberals now.
Well, so we are doing something about it.
Well,
apparently.
you're getting the goodwill that we put in place in 2013. Okay. And I want you to continue on it because it's the right thing to do. But the Prime Minister needs to admit that when he admonished good small business people, he made a mistake because he's not doing the same thing for his buddies in tax havens.
The conflation going on here, you know, again, just stringing all these words together what Canadians need to understand is this problem is being taken very seriously with real resources behind it. at the most senior levels, and that is an international effort. Yeah. We are attacking these tax havens. We are entering tax treaties. That's how you get information back from some of these jurisdictions. But there is a principle, and an enduring one, in international tax law, and it's very simple. If you make a dollar in a country, in terms of revenue or earnings, that dollar should be taxed in that country. Right. And that is obviously the equilibrium point. So, that's the point to which we are all striving, and that's where we will continue to strive.
So here's the one commitment the Liberals could do. One thing. The Parliamentary Budget Officer has been asking on behalf of Canadians how much is owed to the government that isn't being collected from these offshore havens.
He wants one little amendment.
He wants one little thing to work on our behalf.
Well, they're beating down an open door. The minister said today they're going to next year.
Next year.
reveal. Well, it takes a little bit of work to reveal what's called the tax gap on an international basis. The minister in the House today, and I will say, Diane Leboutier, one tough lady, and she is. She's going about this and doing it really well.
So for 2 years, the Liberals have fought against this.
Right.
And now that the pressure hits because the Paradise Papers, and I know who leaked them, Don.
Who?
It was the finance minister.
Oh.
Because you never saw a happier guy today than you saw the finance minister.
Because Machiavelli and diversion.
We're not talking about him anymore. Yeah. Bill looked positively thrilled.
You got a great imagination, Nathan, but maybe not. Who knows? Lisa, I want to talk to a serious point here. I had the minister on to talk about the new sexual harassment legislation. I'm curious, what did you think when you heard it? Does it go far enough? Does it go too far? Is it, how necessary is it on Parliament Hill?
So I'm really familiar with the Labour Code because I sat in that job. I was Labour Minister for a while. So I really needed to take a look at what they're proposing. But the Labour Code is a good place to put stuff like that because it deals with issues in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And Don, it is a serious matter. You know, when I talk to judges or lawyers, crown attorneys in my community, and I say, what's in the courts these days? What is the one thing? It's sexual assault cases. Mm-hmm. And what's happening on campuses? It's sexual assault issues. Mm-hmm. So if I could just say that whatever's happening in the Senate with Rona Ambrose's private members bill, I'd love to see that move along as well in a good spirit to get that moving because we need that as well. So I'm looking forward to see what the minister
How does that get justified? That the House passes a bill, all the parties agree
unanimously
to train judges so that when these cases land in front of them, who are still predominantly men, can be a problem. Mm-hmm. That the Senate is sitting on a bill that the elected people of this country passed to say, get on with it. We're months and months down the road and still nothing from the Senate.
Well, and I'm hoping and I can imagine that this is a nonpartisan issue that will get due scrutiny. Of course, all bills of this scope and scale need due scrutiny. But we'll get cooperation from all parts of the House to make sure it passes, and it represents a significant advance.
There's a culture shift that has to happen here, I would argue. You asked about Parliament Hill.
That's true.
You talk to our female colleagues, Lisa and I have these conversations about what life is like for a female MP, a female staffer, and there's still a culture that pervades that says there's two classes of citizens, true in Parliament Hill as it's true in the country.
Well, even more so in Parliament Hill.
I think
said, you know, there's the dominant, you know, predominantly powerful against the people who need those jobs and stuff. Anyway, I want to move along quickly on a final point. Angus Reid put out a poll. Myanmar's sort of de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, honorary Canadian citizen, they asked the question, should she keep it? Here's the result from people who don't necessarily have a deep understanding of it. They're saying 40% say they should revoke the citizenship. People who actually know a bit more background on this actually goes up to like 60% say revoke it. Stephen, why not revoke it? I know we haven't done that before. We've only had six honorary Canadians in our history, but this seems like a particularly egregious example of someone who doesn't deserve it.
Well, we need facts. And that's why Bob Rae's there. And Bob Rae will be working with our diplomatic corps and our teams on the ground, evaluating what is, by all accounts, a horrific state of affairs. Hundreds of thousands of refugees, vulnerable women and children. Canada obviously needs to act. And I think Canada has taken a real leadership role. Citizenship, it's not something you take lightly. We don't revoke anyone's citizenship lightly, and that's not something we'll be considering until we've established the facts, litigated the case, and come to some sort of international understanding about the best way forward here.
I'm not sure what facts are in dispute here. Well, what do you find? What do you think of this, Lisa?
I'm glad that my colleague Garnet Janus actually asked a question about it in the House today, because I know that we're hearing not necessarily about revoking citizenship, but the issue itself is definitely resonating. So I'm going to give congratulations to the government in appointing Bob Rae to go and find out what's going on behalf of Canadians' behalf. And I think it is important to get those facts to understand it. And, you know, obviously the Liberals do have that point that a Canadian is a Canadian is a Canadian. They've said it many, many times. But if this is egregious enough and serious enough, then we do have to make sure that we do the right thing.
But our first priority has to be on aid, assistance.
Right, I agree with that. Yeah, I think that's the thing that Canadians are most concerned about is what's happening in the region and what Canada should do. In terms of the citizenship, I guess she was a hero for me going through college. Like, you just, for many Canadians, she just represented determination against an extreme government. Would we grant her a citizenship today, an honorary citizenship? Yeah. Given what we know to this point, I think that would be much more. I mean, the facts need still to bear out. I think Stephen's right, but probably not. Mm-hmm. So is there a place that we can look at this and then reassess? Maybe. We've never done it, so this would be
a more or less a consensus. We'll wait and see and find out then. Okay, thank you all.
Thank you, John.
We'll see you next week. We'll see you the week after next.
And we'll be talking taxes.
You bet. Still, probably. Coming up, the veil is lifted on a charter challenge in Quebec. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, what was seen as an inevitable challenge to Quebec's face-covering law was launched today. The ethics of the challenge is a section of the bill which says that personnel members of a body must exercise their functions with their face uncovered. Similarly, persons who request a service from a personnel member of a body referred to in this chapter must have their face uncovered when that service is provided. The Premier of Quebec insists this is charter-proof.
We deliberately wrote a bill that respects the charters, and we're very confident.
Oh, well, the National Council of Canadian Muslims and the Canadian Civil Liberties Association have a different view. They filed a 25-page challenge to the bill, seeking to suspend its implementation. Challenge lawyer Catherine McKenzie joins us from Montreal. Ms. McKenzie, I'm just curious if you could tell us quickly what the grounds are. You believe Quebec government's wrong, that this could actually be a freedom of religion issue.
Yeah, the Quebec Charter and Canadian Charter protect freedom of religion and also equality. And we think that that's being violated in this case because women, mostly Muslim women, are being forced to choose between exercising their freedom of religion and their sincerely held religious beliefs and accessing public services.
You've brought forward a couple of plaintiffs as examples. Could you give us a quick sort of synopsis of what their story and experience is?
Sure. So there's one individual plaintiff, Marie-Michelle, and she's a woman in her 30s who came to Islam later in her life and chose to wear the veil. And she's experienced harassment and isolation even before the law came into effect. But since it's come into effect, she's really living in sort of a state of fear about how to access public services and how she's going to be treated just out in the public, given this signal from the government. And our second affiant, so she's not actually a plaintiff, but she's there providing affidavit evidence, is a McGill student who's 21 who came to wear the veil under different circumstances, but feels the same. Really, in the end, their experiences are not that different. And as a student, she's worried about having access to her classes and uncomfortable riding public transportation.
How quickly might you be able to get before a court, and could you suspend this bill fairly quickly, at least the implementation in the short term?
Well, that is what we're asking for. The legal terms are a little complicated, but we're hoping, if it all works out, to be heard next week. But it's not always possible to get heard quickly, given the volume of cases that the courts have in front of them.
Yeah, help me sort this out. Are you looking or expecting or asking for the federal government to do any intervention on this?
We're not asking them to do it. We have sent them what's the notice that's required. And there has been talk on their part to do it. But I think that's a complicated decision that probably has politics involved, too. So we'll let them decide if they want to show up for that and support this application.
Now, you don't... I know when the minister initially introduced it, there was talk that you were going to have to wear the
to remove the veil for like a bus ride or to get hospital care, and they seem to soften it down to where you'd have to show it for identification, your face for identification purposes, and that would be about it. Has that reduced, in your view, how much of a breach of or potential breach of the charter that this is?
I don't think so. I mean, these are not official regulations that have been passed. They're guidelines from the minister, and we'll see what their legal value is later. But the law still contains a blanket prohibition on either working for the, you know, many, many public services or receiving public services. And it doesn't say that it's just for identification purposes. So we still think that the law is much too broad not required by any situation that exists right now.
Are you thinking this thing's invariably headed to the Supreme Court of Canada?
I've been asked that question a lot today. I'm focused on next week, and we'll see what happens after that.
And, of course, you know, there's always the notwithstanding clause to get out of any ruling down the road, but the politicians were running away from that today. I guess that's still a possibility at the end of this long legal road.
Sure. I mean, they can do that at any time. Of course, they've really only ever invoked that in some very rare occasions. There's a lot of political fallout and, you know, it's a difficult decision to invoke that. But if they do, we'll face that if it happens. But right now, that hasn't happened.
All right. You're taking the first steps. I think it's a long road. Catherine McKenzie, thanks for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
All right, coming up, a hockey memorial and a short-term skating rink are signature Canada 150 grand finales. The press gallery talks about their $7.5 million price after these messages. Please stay with us. Welcome back. It's time for Tuesday's tremendously talented twosome of intrepid reporters. Tanya McCharles writes for the Toronto Star. I work on these. Robert Fife is bureau chief for the Globe and Mail.
Thank you.
That's why you were such a good columnist.
Oh, yes. Yes. Anyway.
Alliteration.
Yeah. Okay. Tell me about this sexual harassment bill, Tanya. You were at the news conference. I heard you asking some questions about it. Is it really feasible to implement this on Parliament Hill? You were sort of pointing out there's some small offices, and how the heck do you file a complaint against someone?
I think it is if they force employers to identify a neutral third party. And, yeah, that's going to get around the instances where a young staffer or an aide or an intern is subject, you know, if it's her boss, her employer, the MP, harassing her, or young men for that matter, being harassed. They have to agree at the outset in their contracts, you know, in the employment in the office, that somebody else will decide these complaints. And they have to be, the minister or the MP or the senator has to be able to show the government, the employment department, that, yeah, we've got a plan. Here it is. Here's our designated third party. Look, I think it's long overdue. I mean, people were talking about whether it's timely. It's long overdue. It's going to enact stronger protections for the RCMP and for civilian employees at the military. I think this, if they manage to get it passed with the support of the opposition parties, could potentially have long-reaching effects.
Bob?
I think it's really important, and I'm glad they've done this. It's 2017, and that place remains an institution where women are still sexually harassed, and there are no avenues for them, really, to be able to go and say, this MP is potentially my boss, or another MP is sexually harassing me. What can I do about it? I mean, the Canadian Human Rights Code doesn't even apply up there. So I'm really glad that they're bringing this legislation. I bet you there are a lot of women on the Hill that are very happy that this is taking place, too. It's been long, long overdue.
And not just on the Hill. You know, look, it's enacting a fairer process for complainants in a whole range of workplaces. Now, granted, federally regulated workplaces are a small percentage of the Canadian workforce, 8 or 10%, I think. But still, at least it's backstopping those employees. Provincial regulations, you know, like Ontario's brought in an act similar to this one. Mm-hmm. So some provinces are also trying to take care of other workplaces. Yeah, I think it's a good measure.
The Canadian Labour Congress makes a good point, too. They haven't provided a clear definition of sexual harassment and violence, which they do in other provincial jurisdictions, like Ontario, for example.
And they also haven't prescribed sanctions for the offenders. So this doesn't set out how the harasser will get slapped down, but it sets out sanctions for the employer who doesn't take care of the harasser.
I want to quickly get your thoughts on Rachel Notley. She's embarking on a tour of Eastern Canada to sort of sell pipelines. I think there's a genuine worry in Alberta that no pipeline could end up being built, and they've got to get their increased production out. She also sort of took a bit of a shot at Jagmeet Singh, saying he's irrelevant, even though, because he's opposed to these pipelines. I guess I'm curious, Bob, is she going to find any support in Eastern Canada for a pipeline, or is she just going to encounter resistance when she gets here?
Well, Jason Kenney, who was the conservative leader, saying that she's taken this page from his book is something he's been telling her to do for months, and
obvious,
she is doing it. look, you've got to go, she has to go out and sell this because they have a legitimate case here. They have a resource that they can't get to market, and they can't get it to world price. We have to sell it to the Americans at a much lower price than we can get on the world
stage.
It's like 40
bucks now, right?
And
like
more. Canadian. And what's missing in all of this is that if Alberta can sell it at a world price, this is going to be more money for health care, for all the kind of social programs, as well as for jobs, in Ontario and in Quebec. So good for her.
I think she's still going to come up against a big fight in Quebec. I mean, I don't think that the woman who's replacing Denis Coderre as mayor of Montreal is any great fan of it either. There's a huge public opinion backlash against that project in Quebec. And even though New Brunswick wants it, she's still going to have to fight that battle. And, the federal government is not going to be a big ally in the sense that they can't be seen to be trying to determine that result. I mean, they advocate a proper process, an environmental process, right, but they're not pushing the pipeline project. So.
Trans Mountain is the one that they need. They've got to get that one. I'm not sure that oil prices where they are now would make a west-east pipeline very feasible, but certainly if they can get the oil much quicker to the west coast and to Asia, Alberta will be sitting a lot better, but so will Canada.
And energy east, right, I forgot they weren't going ahead anyway. So pipeline politics are fascinating in this country, and it's just too bad it's always so regionally divisive.
Yeah. I think we're going to have her on the show tomorrow, so stay tuned for that.
Good.
Finally, Canada 150 birthday bash is going out with a big bang of bucks. Here's the $5 million ice rink that'll stay open for about 3 weeks on Parliament Hill. You can't see it behind me because it's dark. And then there's a $2.5 million Stanley Cup Memorial that just opened. I would bring up that the National Holocaust Monument isn't going to open this winter because they don't put snow shoveling on it. But anyway,
$2 million.
That's the one. Bob, we've lived our lives, shaking our heads at government spending. This has got to rank up there, doesn't it?
I encourage anybody, if you're from outside Ottawa, come and take a look at this Stanley Cup. It's hard to believe that cost $2.5 million. Francois, our cameraman behind here, he's a very handy guy with his hands. He could have built that. I probably could get him to do it for $100. And in terms of the arena that we're putting up on Parliament Hill, I guess nobody's told the bureaucrats that we have the Rideau Canal and City Hall has an
City
arena.
City Hall, just over a few blocks away, has an outdoor arena refrigerated in the wintertime. So
I guess if they thought they were going to have the NHL game there, there was some talk.
There was going to be a big hockey game with the kids, I gather. Yeah. But
that's $5 million. But for a couple of weeks.
Am I missing something? Do you see a lot of the purse strings seem pretty loose with this government that's different from the Harper government?
Well, I mean, the Harper government spent too, but, look at all.
Well, let's not forget the gazebos Tony Clements riding and the fake lake. Yeah. Remember the fake lake at the G20 summit? How much did that cost? That was
$1 million. And all those economic signs everywhere.
I think governments of all political stripes kind of tend to toss around the loose change, what they consider loose change, pretty randomly when there's a big event or something to celebrate or something to show off with. But, it couldn't come at a worse time for them.
I'll stick with this theme just because you guys are being so efficient with time. I actually have like a minute and a half left,
but
I'm
curious.
Did we run
out? No, come on.
No, don't run out of time. We can't go anywhere. Has the 150 birthday been what you would consider a success in terms of what the federal government's done, or is it left something to be desired.
Oh, I think some of the events have been hugely successful.
The giant and duck, right?
La Machine, the big machine dragon affair that they had here in this city was a huge tourist draw for the city of Ottawa. And they've had other events that have been really successful.
The biggest
six. But I don't know that it's those the benefits have been spread equally across the country. It seems every province got a few projects that were paid for, but.
To me, the biggest success was the fact that they didn't charge people to go into Canada's parks for the summer. And I bet you when we see the final figures, there are going to have huge numbers of Canadians who actually went and got to see what their country's like.
Yeah, but there's still a lot of money that no one really knows where it was spent, or if it know where it was spent, it didn't seem to have much bang for the buck.
Well, look, I think the Ottawa area residents got the biggest bang for the buck because a lot of the parties were here, the big celebrations, money went into a huge garden sculpture event over across the river in Gatineau.
The Canada Day celebrations that nobody could get on the hill to see.
Got a little rained out. Okay, well, you guys are so efficient today. Didn't even have to talk out the clock. It's all done for me. Okay, thanks very much. We appreciate you coming on. That is the show for today. Scott Laurie standing by with the latest news headlines. We are back tomorrow. It'll be the same time, the same channel. Probably some very different political power plays in Canada and around the world on the first anniversary of Donald Trump's election victory. All right, stay tuned. Hope you can stay with us tomorrow. We'll see you then. Thanks for watching.